reconvene at 1:50 this afternoon. We left off with some questions that will be held until Mr. Sager arrives. Senator Walker had some. There may be some others. Mr. Reeder, thanks for coming back. Perhaps if you're willing, we'll bring you up at that time. Would that be okay that we bring you up when Mr. Sager comes up? What we'll do is move to some public testimony. Bill Cluding. And then following that, we'll have Rob Kramer.
Thank you, Madam Chair Flores, Chair Devlin, Committee. I want to thank you for allowing me to speak today. Last session, one of the very important things that got passed right off the bat was the House Joint Memorial Number 1.
And Mr. Cluding, I'm sorry, even though I've said it, I do need to have you state your name for the record.
My name is Bill Cluding. I live in Monmouth, Oregon, 6600 Cooper Hollow.
Thank you.
Thank you. The Secure Rural Schools and Community Self-Determined Act is going to expire this year. We talked about the Department of Human Services having a budget shortfall. If this law is not enacted again this year, we're talking $600 million every 2 years that goes to the counties and schools. I'm going to meet with Senator Wyden tomorrow. He's having a town hall meeting in Independence. We're going to discuss what his thoughts are on this. Even as tight as our school budget money is today, even with this, I'd hate to see what's going to happen without the majority of this money coming in every 2 years. I've talked to some of the county commissioners and county officials, and they say, well, if we don't get it, all we got to do is lay off crews and not do any major repair work. Oh, that's easy for a county to do, but what's a school going to do? I think we've already spent this money that we think we're going to get. If we don't get it, I don't know what you folks are going to do. I think through testimony you heard that I don't think there's a school district out there that's not squeezing every dime out of their dollar that they get. I don't think you can find any frivolous spending in a school district. But what I'd like to refer to is the layers above the school district. There's a education service districts that are doing their job, they're doing it right. But there's some districts are not spending our tax dollars the way they should be spent. And any lost tax dollar in that group of dealings that we read about every day, it should be going directly to the K-12 classroom for the students. I urge this committee to, in the future, look at some sort of restraints on spending for these education service districts, monitor how they spend our tax dollars, because every dollar that's misspent hurts somebody in a classroom. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Mr. Cluding?
No. Madam Chair.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. I just want to thank Mr. Cluding for coming today. He's communicated with me by email some of these issues and concerns, and I let him know that you and I worked on the ESD reform bill last session, and we do have some reforms in place, but it's very, very difficult, as I explained to Mr. Cluding in the email, to get much reform on ESDs in this building. But we made a start, and we're sure going to keep after it, and I totally understand. In fact, I was having a conversation with Representative Morgan today about the money that that some of our counties are going to lose if we don't reauthorize the rural schools bill. So we are all very much concerned about that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Devlin?
I would point out that one of the elements of that bill, although it seems relatively minor, there was a feeling, particularly in some of the Ways and Means Committees, that the appropriation level for ESDs was just slightly higher than it needed to be. Now, it didn't create any additional dollars for education, mm-hmm. but we lowered the amount very slightly by about a quarter percentage point for ESDs, and that money ends up going back to school districts. And I think that means about $10 million this biennium, and I believe it'll mean about $22-25 next biennium, depending upon what the funding level is. So, I mean, we did try to redirect some more money back to school districts from ESDs, and Senator Walker also had, in terms of that reform bill, and other people worked on it, also the issue that we've tried some experimental governance models with ESD, and my ESD in particular, one of my ESDs, the Northwest ESD, Senator Starr is also giving the school boards more direct control over the ESD.
And Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, the Willamette ESD is one of the star pupils of that reform effort, and we chose them with their history in mind, and so we couldn't have been more dead on right about that one. So I look forward to making sure that we have those funds accountable to taxpayers.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for coming today.
Have a good day.
Thank you, too. Rob Kramer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Rob Kramer. I'm with the Oregon Education Coalition offices in Portland. I want to just take a brief moment, and I promise that I will be brief, to talk a little bit about the quality education model and ballot measure one. Ballot measure one, of course, requires the legislature fund schools adequately to meet Oregon's quality education goals or explain why. And we know also additional statute has been passed that essentially codifies the quality education model as defining those quality education goals, or you can feel free to adopt a different model if it is based on research. What I'd like to say about that is to call into question the value of the quality education model or any similar approach when answering the question, what will it take to get us to meet our quality education goals? Now, I was around in 97 when the quality education model was kind of put in place, and I followed the process by which the model's been developed and the Quality Education Commission has gone about its work. The central premise behind the quality education model is developing an optimal school model and asking the question, if every school in Oregon was to be funded sufficient to make it look like the model, how much would that cost? But the assumption behind that is that if every school did look like the quality education model, then 90% of kids would meet standard. I ask you, have you ever seen any evidence of that assertion, that assertion is true? That if every school did look like the quality education model's optimal school, that 90% of children would meet standard? Because that is the central premise of this entire exercise. Yet I have never seen an iota of evidence that would suggest that such an outcome would be the result of funding the schools to that level. Now, I would suggest if the central premise of this process is itself has no basis in any support or even any documentary evidence, then the exercise of explaining why we did not fund the schools to the quality education model prototype level is an exercise in futility. Now, another side point is that if the legislature did fund the schools to that level of $7.1 billion or $7.2 billion, there's no requirement that the schools, school districts, actually use the money and reshape their schools to the quality education model. So there again, even if you did fund the schools sufficiently, I think there would be trepidation if you were to try to mandate that all the schools reshaped their own school buildings to look like anticipated in the model, 20 kids per classroom, a counselor for every 270 kids, or whatever those parameters are. So I would just suggest to you that the notion that there is such thing as a prototype school or an optimal school model is wrong. That is a flawed assumption. It's a flawed premise, but that's the premise from which we have launched here. Now, what would be a better premise? Maybe the premise that we don't know what the optimal school might look like. I am the co-founder of four charter schools called the Arthur Academy Neighborhood Public Schools, operating up and around Portland, Oregon. And we will be building an additional seven of those schools. They do meet the quality goals. At least they so far have met the quality goals of Oregon. 95% of our children met standard when they were taking the test for the first time. But our schools don't look anything like the optimal school model. Our schools do not have 20 kids per class. Our schools do not have counselors. They don't follow the quality school model at all. Yet we are meeting the quality education goals. So I would just suggest that perhaps this process by which we're endlessly talking about the problem that we aren't funding our schools to the quality education model is in itself a flawed process. Now, I understand you're bound to a certain extent by statute, but statutes can be changed. I would point out ballot measure 1 says nothing about the quality education model. It's not a constitutional requirement that the quality education model defines the quality education goals for the state of Oregon. And in fact, until I would hope that you would agree, it's irresponsible to accept an assertion with no evidence, that assertion being if we funded the schools to the level of the model, that 90% of kids would meet statute. We should not be, 90% of kids would meet standards. We should not be making public policy based on assertions that are not supported by evidence. With that, I'll end, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Kramer? Senator Starr.
The Arthur Academies that you referred to, they are operating with state funds.
Uh-huh. Yes, they are.
At a greatly reduced level than other public schools.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, yes, depending on how you compare the funding levels, our schools operate on 80% of the per student ADM money. Roughly, in an all funds basis, that comes out to about $4,200 per student. And that's after our startup costs are paid, which are primarily grant funds, but in the operating expenditures, about $4,200 per student. The typical school district in Oregon on an all-funds, apples-to-apples comparison is spending in the $8,000 to $9,000 per student area.
Further question, please.
Follow-up.
95% of your students are at grade level when tested. And this is accomplished by a particular method of teaching?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, yes, we use the University of Oregon-based direct instruction model for teaching reading and mathematics. Very well researched. It's the most research-validated reading and math instructional model in the universe, frankly. It uses phonics, and it uses a very traditionally sequenced mathematics curriculum. And it's very, very successful. Now, I don't want to overclaim our results. We've only had one class of third graders go through our schools because we start our schools kindergarten through grade 2, and then we add one grade each year until they're K-5. So we've only had one class take the Oregon statewide assessment. On that test, 95% of our kids did meet the state standard. Many of them exceeded it. However, we do also, every year in kindergarten through 5th grade, give a Stanford achievement test. And so we know what percentile our kids are in well before we test them at the statewide level in third grade. And we know the results in our earlier grades is fabulous. We're virtually certain we'll be able to maintain 95% or better meeting standard.
Further question, please.
Follow up.
The teachers that you're able to hire, are they prepared through their teacher training schools to teach the University of Oregon's phonics, phonemic awareness by direct instruction?
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, generally the answer to that question is no, they are not. We do hire teachers that have been trained at the University of Oregon in the in the curriculum itself. And typically those are teachers who have gotten a special education certification at University of Oregon, which is where this curriculum has originated. But beyond that, every other college of education, at least in Oregon, basically does not believe in this methodology and does not teach it to their teacher candidates. And so we are forced to do our own training, and we have a full month-long teacher training institute every single August before school starts to teach our teachers, our new teachers, and to do retraining on our current teachers in this program.
Thank you.
Further questions? Oh, I mean, Representative, I almost gave you a promotion, didn't I?
I don't know if it's a promotion or not. Thank you. I just have one question. What in your schools, what's the percentage of special needs children and non-English speaking children?
Madam Chair, Representative Riley, it varies. We have a school in Reynolds School District, one in David Douglas School District, one in Portland School District, and one in Woodburn. And so as you might imagine, the demographics of the kids in those schools are reflective of the areas, and therefore it varies considerably. In our Woodburn school, more than 60% have a Hispanic surname. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't speak English well. It probably means they speak Spanish at home, but not necessarily. And we have yet to be able to convince the school district to allow us to access the ESL funds for those kids, because they're putting so many requirements on us, they basically are withholding those funds from us. So we don't classify them yet as English as a second language. As far as special needs, special education, it's a very interesting question. With the curriculum that we use, we identify far fewer kids as special education than the other public schools, because the curriculum itself is so effective when a teacher knows how to use it in getting the kids to read. We avoid the problems that sometimes would pop up if we used a less effective reading curriculum. And so I don't frankly know the percentage of our kids who are special education, but I would I don't know the exact percentage. I know for a fact it's far below the 11% or 12%, which is a statewide average. We're probably more like 3%, and most of those came with an early childhood designation of special education. We didn't identify them. We avoid that. We try to avoid that.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kramer. A couple of housekeeping matters before we proceed. I see we do have one more to come in as public testimony. Ms. Smith, if you can hold, if you wouldn't mind. I know that you enjoy being in the audience this afternoon. Thank you very much. Mr. Sager, thank you very much for making yourself available. And as you move forward, another housekeeping matter. Number one, I note that we do have a copy of the governor's report that Senator Devlin had mentioned and that you had affirmed. So we have that Jim got to us very, very timely manner. And if I might take the liberty to make just a record correction or notation, Senator Devlin, when you had mentioned about the state not being involved in capital construction costs, in 97-99, in fact, there were lottery bonds, $150 million in education lottery bonds that went directed themselves that way. So for the record, and if that piece of documentation is in front of you as
we
well.
We used a lot of creative mechanisms.
Well, isn't that just a real name? Creative. And Mr. Reeder, if you would like to come up as well. Thank you. So having heard from both of the panelists earlier, I suspect there are questions then for one or both. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have some questions for Mr. Sager. I'm going to start out, if I might, with the final number that you say is the final education number, because I think this committee needs to understand what that is so that we know if we've met the model or we've met the funding needs for our kids. So, Madam Chair, if I could just go ahead and ask a couple questions,
please.
Mr. Sager, you said that $5.318 billion is the final number, not what OEA says. And I wrote down what OEA said, and they said $5.263 billion, and that was a number that one of the boys referred to, COSA or OSBA, agreed was the proper number. So could you please tell me what the difference is between your analysis of the final number and their analysis, and mine as well, please?
Co-Chair Flores and Devlin and Senator Walker, if you remember, between December 1st and the time that we came to a final budget, additional local revenue, what is classified as local revenue, became available to the system. And so, again, if you think of the process that we go through, that is we roll up all the costs, here's the total, we subtract out local, here's what's left for the state level, it balances out to the total. And so the discussions that took place amongst legislative leaders and the governor and others was to try and put a package together that hit that 5318 target, including those additional local dollars and the actual legislative budget. We got there. Now, it's kind of like creative financing, as Senator Devlin said a few moments ago. But again, at least it became a target. It has also, in the mind and statements of the governor, become the baseline. So when he talks about his future growth of the education budget for each sector, for K-12, his starting number from this current biennium is that 5318 number. So that's why I'm not trying to be specific on where those dollars came from. I'm trying to identify the value of that number.
Mr. Sager, have we ever counted local revenues before in the total number that we've assigned to K-12 budget?
Senator Walker, I'm not sure what all the various actions have been. I mean,
there's 74 legislative assemblies, I don't expect you to answer that question.
No, but my point being, for instance, we have counted the accrual method as part of the system to allow school districts to balance their budgets, even though they're not allowed to run in a deficit. So all I'm suggesting is that there have been a variety of takes and puts into the system. And so I'm not trying to justify that 5318 was the amount of money that came out of the general fund and lottery from the legislature. My point being was that became a target during the legislative process. Collectively, we got to that target. We used some additional local revenues or counted them as part of getting to that target. The next step then is, what is the value of that target for the future? And the value is that is the number that the governor feels is the starting point, and he is going to build from that point forward. So regardless that we're a percentage point off, because it's about equal to a percentage point, that is what he is planning to look at for his December 1 budget as the starting point.
Oh, yeah, and one final question on this point, and then I have another point. Well, I read the governor's report on my lunch hour, and on page 9, he says, evaluation, what is the reason for the insufficiency, and then talks about how we have a problem with revenue in this state. And then his third paragraph says, I know some would seek to avoid such painful choices by arguing for a borrowing package to provide more money for our schools and our vulnerable citizens. So while he didn't borrow, he kind of did, because you did some creative financing by using local funds. Would you go so far as to agree with me on that?
Co-Chair Flores and Devlin, Senator Walker, no, I would disagree with you. I think the governor was very clear that he wanted to end the use of the state credit card to fund ongoing operations, and that we had to bring budget discipline to bear so that, in fact, we could pay for the decisions we were making. That was his target. There had been a lot of discussion at the time that this was being prepared of looking at going out and having further bonding to provide revenue for operations, which are ongoing expenses. It's one thing to bond to build a building that you know is going to be available for 30 years. It's another thing to bond to pay for the operation of a program for a year when that program has to continue. And that just keeps digging the hole deeper. If I remember correctly, we had about a $600 million hole and balancing the budget as the rollover from one biennium to the next, because about $600 million worth of operational expenses had been paid for out of one-time money, borrowing, et cetera. And the governor was trying to make it clear that wasn't something that he was interested in doing. And so the view of the dollars as they flow in to the general fund, and the case of the example you're using of those local revenues, he didn't view it as a borrowing approach, but actually utilizing the revenue that was there and was coming forward, and let's make sure that the schools get it.
All right, thank you. And now my last line of inquiry, Madam Chair.
Before we move to that, did you have a question, Senator Devlin, on this point?
I just wanted to clarify an issue about the 5318, if I could, if that's okay. I think you indicated it fairly clearly. The 5318 was the figure basically about the same time as the governor's budget came out. And that's the figure that's used that needs to be plugged in, not to meet the quality education model level, but to meet the essential budget level. Okay. All during the session, that number was adjusted up and down. That number went up when the PERS rate for school employees came in higher than anticipated. That number went down when the health care rate was adjusted for school employees in the first year. And that number went down, obviously, because that's the plug-in number for all revenues, when there was more local revenue than there was in December, both in terms of the additional common school fund, and there was some little slight adjustment somewhere there where of a couple $1 million more local revenue. So that was the number that from December on just fluctuated back and forth. And I can tell you, I think I had Sue McGlashan do about four different runs of that number during the session. But that was not a number that was ever, you know, just solidly in place.
Right. Okay, thank you. Now, Madam Chair, I need to ask the Governor's Office how the QEM figured into their calculations. We learned today, Mr. Sager, from Ms. Massey, that the draft of the QEM is prepared in August and provided to the Governor's Office. Is that correct? And
yes.
You received it?
We sure did.
Okay. So then you were aware of what those numbers were going to be, pretty much. And yet, now you may dispute this because Senator Devlin and I were discussing this here, but I sat on the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee, and I saw the graphs, and sometimes I don't read a graph correctly, but I saw the education budget, and it was below the line, and it was the only agency budget that was below the line. So my question is, if you saw the QEM and what was required, then why did the K-12 budget come in as the only agency budget that didn't get an increase?
Co-Chairs Flores and Devlin, Senator Walker, I remember us having conversations about this before, and it a lot of it had to do with looking at the total revenue picture for education and how the different... how you present the values of the dollars and the growth in the dollars of the different elements. At the time, as I mentioned earlier today, from the time the governor prepared his budget until we were able to sign EDI, we had an increase of over $500 million that we collectively could work with, and collectively we put a substantial portion of that into education, K-12 and other sectors. The governor made it clear from day one with this report, even before that when he released his budget, that it wasn't enough and that he was dedicated to, if more real revenue became available, he was going to direct it that way. In February, when the first new revenue forecast came out, I believe it was a shift of about $250 million that took place at that time. He immediately had a press conference where he stated very clearly he wanted to restore the cut in Oregon Pre-K Head Start. He wanted to fill the the hole that we had discovered in the community college because of the way, the historical way that the roll-up costs had been calculated, and that he wanted money to go into K-12 education. So all along he's been very consistent that he's acknowledged when something has been inadequate and that he has been committed to addressing that inadequacy when it comes to education. So, you know, where we are now is he continues to say that he is advocating and will advocate for additional revenue that he can dedicate to this plan. So we use the model not only to discuss the budget, but then to also understand, based on the model, what the potential impacts could be, which led to this report that you have in front of you. Again, that's why we pulled examples out of the model to say, here are the potential impacts of this level of funding. It's not adequate. This is what could happen. Let's be honest about it. And then worked very diligently to try and fill that hole to help keep us at least even so that, in fact, these potential scenarios didn't become a reality.
Senator Walker, would you mind if I interposed a question?
Yeah, I just have one question after you're done.
That brings up the question, then, Mr. Sager, as I'm looking at the governor's recommended budget on page B3. Key elements of the governor's recommended budget are, at that point, recommending $5 billion in state resources for school funding. The combined increase in state and local funding results in a 4.1 increase in resources for schools. The budget is expected to stabilize school funding after the past several years of unpredictable and varying funding levels. So that sounds almost contrary to what you just said as far as acknowledging underfunding.
Right. Co-Chair Flores, let me try to clarify that. What the governor did not want to have occur again was for us to put forward a budget and the legislature act on a budget that would create unsustainable expectation. That's what we had been through the previous two bienniums, where we talk about a number. We talked about this earlier with 2001. We were going to put an extra $120 million in. People make changes in the program. The other half of the equation makes the commitment, and then we pull it out from under them. He wanted to make sure that the budget was based on real dollars, that we could be pretty confident are secure. And so that's why, as the revenue projections improved and people felt solid with those numbers, he made it clear to you and working with you all, you know, that we needed to prioritize those dollars and put a significant amount of that into education. So the stabilizing was to not have this, to try and end this up and down roller coaster that we've had with education. He wants us now to continue to build upon that stability and be able to begin to reinvest in the system.
Thank you. Senator?
Thank you. This is my final question, Mr. Sager. Thank you for bearing with me. I just want to kind of understand the governor's position as we write this report and look at the value of the quality education model. You know, I chaired the education committee last session, and we had a lot of angry people. We had a lot of angry people come in front of the committee and talk about the cuts, and even the governor on page 12 in his expectation for student performance should these cuts go into place lists that improvement rate in reading and math and will flatten out. Students will have fewer opportunities in academic areas, and there were numerous other cuts that were laid out, that counselors were cut in middle schools and high schools, and, you know, we have teen suicide is the third highest rate of death, reason for death here in the state for young people. And it's an issue I've worked on for a long time. So we've really put our kids at risk by cutting the budget. You have indicated in your testimony, and I quoted it, we use this model because it's a good tool, when you were talking about the QEM. So if you got the QEM in August, you lowballed the education number when it came out, and you improved it a teeny bit, where do we go from here? What do we tell people who bring their tin cup to the Capitol? What does the QEM mean to the governor of the state of Oregon? We're going to tell them what it means when we write our report. But I'd like you to tell me what it means and what's the plan. What's the plan here to meet the QEM? And if it has value, then why didn't we see that in the budget?
Co-chairs Flores and Devlin, Senator Walker, you might need to help me remember all the pieces of your question, but I'm going to try to cover them. First of all, I need to make it clear that the examples provided in the report, as the examples have been provided in previous reports, are just that. In other words, it's a recognition that these are the potential tough decisions that school districts around the state might have to make. This is not a prescription of how school districts have to spend their money. This is not a directive from the governor or the legislature or anyone else to say, and so here's where you need to cut. This is just a recognition that, again, looking at the model, looking at the baseline of the model, which at that point was 5318, and if we are $318 million below that, here's potentially what school districts are going to have to grapple with. So again, to try and lay out an honest picture of what we're facing, the current revenue structure with the series of priorities that the governor had laid out, education, health care, etc. This was his best shot, opening shot of a balanced budget that met a variety of needs. We had people from human services and all other sections of the budget come in and say, this isn't enough. Please don't cut our program. This is, you know, a necessary program. And all of these are very compelling arguments. So the governor used this to recognize what the impact of that decision was, but also, like I said, made it clear from day one that his priority was to restore this funding level into the system so that these kinds of cuts wouldn't have to take place. And he worked with you to succeed or come close to succeeding that, depending upon how you look at that number. So that provided the stability. Now you asked for the plan for the future. The governor has laid out a plan, and since the governor is the one that gets to put out the December 1st budget, this is the plan he is going to be following, and that is he has made it clear that from this point forward, he wants to see a 10% increase in the education enterprise funding. So each sector of the enterprise, Oregon Pre-K, K-12, community college, university, the three schools of education at OHSU, the opportunity grants, the whole continuum that he has laid out, a 10% increase as the opening number, because he feels it is important that we provide stability and predictability to school districts, community colleges, universities, so that they can make long-term planning, and so that we can stop the infighting that takes place because of the structure we have set up in the legislature, where we first bring in one sector, then we bring in another sector, and it's all disjointed and segmented to where we never get to see how all of these pieces interact and a change here, how it might affect a change somewhere else. And historically, at the end of the day, the sectors have come out and they've kind of looked at each other and said, well, were you a winner or a loser? That's got to end. We have to talk about the education enterprise as the system winning and raising the system. And so that is the directive that the governor has made very clear. That is what he'll be bringing forward in December. And the work of the joint boards is designed around looking at not only identifying the future vision, looking out 20, 25 years for education, but also what are those incremental changes, both structurally, alignment issues, et cetera, that will provide efficiencies, that will make the system more effective, and how would we invest dollars over time to make these things a reality? State money coupled with local resources, coupled with the other mystery money that Representative Morgan mentioned and others, so that we have a plan that Oregonians understand and they recognize the value they're getting for their dollar.
Madam Chair, true to my word, I asked a very compound question, so I wouldn't have to tell you I needed another question. So I'm not going to ask another question, even though one came to my mind. Thank you.
Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a comment, and then I had a question that goes a little bit beyond this committee. It's just a statement that you made, Mr. Sagert. The first comment that I'd like to make is when the governor put together his budget, he had approximately somewhat less than $500 million less than what we had to balance the budget in the end. So I expected he had to make more difficult choices than we had to make in putting that budget together. And I did actually thank Mr. Sager and thank the governor that when you did the ballot measure one statement, you made it very clear what you thought the impacts would be. You didn't try to sugarcoat it at all. You didn't say that these could be easily overcome. But they're now going, that's all on the positive side. Now I'm going to go over to the other side. If you use the 5318 or whatever figure it is as a starting point, I just want a clarification on the record, and I'm not going to hold you to your answer on the record. Is that being used in a vacuum? I know you talked about looking at the other areas in education and their needs also, but is that being looked at in a vacuum as compared to the other funding sources for K-12? Because I saw an estimate, and I don't know that if this will play out, but Fortune magazine just put out an article basically on overvalued markets in real estate, and Portland metropolitan area came in 56th, and they were predicting that they would have in the next year only about a 3% increase in market value, and in the following year they'd probably have about a 0.7% decline in market value. My memory may be wrong, but my understanding under Measure 50 is we can change assessed value up to 3%. I do not know if we can change it actually if assessed value doesn't actually increase, or if market value doesn't actually increase. And also, because of the situation that the federal government is in, and I know we all started out with high hopes back in this prior year that there would be more funding for special needs children coming from the federal government, and that never materialized. And we might also anticipate in the future that might even decline, or some other areas. Are we going to look at the 5318 in a vacuum of all those others? Are we going to look at in terms of what the total cost is, and what's the governor's commitment to look at addressing that total cost?
Well, Senator Devlin, I appreciate the multiplicity of questions that you asked also. First of all, and again, repeat something if I fail to make a note here to myself. As far as the impact of market and assessed values, it's going to be real hard to anticipate that because there has been a lot of work done on the fact that market value and assessed value are not in alignment as they're supposed to be. And so simply because the real market value only went up 1%, that doesn't mean that the assessed value, which is supposed to be in relationship to market value, doesn't adjust. I mean, there are some complicated calculations there, and we'll see what the county assessors and others do on that. The real concern about the future loss of federal dollars is something that we are watching very carefully, and we have been working with our congressional delegation to try and explain to them the negative impacts of a lot of decisions that are being made as we speak. So we're monitoring that very carefully. I think what you have to do is recognize that if all things remain the same, making a commitment of a 10% increase of the general fund contribution to schools is a real change in the process that we have done. As we've mentioned before, historically we figure the total, we subtract out local. Yeah. So this, you know, this is a substantial commitment to education, and each sector of the education has that same commitment. It's not just K-12. And so that's the first part of your question was, you know, is it just K-12 or is it the other elements? It's all elements of the education enterprise. If, in fact, federal dollars are cut, we're going to have to collectively look at that and say, what can we do to help fill that hole? This also does not prevent policy packages from coming forward, and they will. They will come forward from the governor. They will come forward from all of you and others saying, here's a particular investment in the system that we think is important, and so we need to find additional dollars for it. The other part of it is that the general fund is estimated to grow by 12%. At least that's the number we've been using. And so following the lead of the speaker's plan, where she took the additional growth above 10% and put it into the two-side accounts, the governor supports that approach. Two-thirds of that helping to fill the stability fund quicker, so that way we make sure it's there. And he supports increasing that to a 10% cap instead of the current 5%. and one-third going into an investment fund where, again, we can strategically target throughout the system the best place to put that dollar. And so now it may end up that that investment money may have to be looked at, for instance, to say there's going to be this cut in federal funds in some sector of the education continuum, and so the best thing to do would be to plug the hole there. Those are the kinds of decisions that we have to make, and he's willing to take the hard look at. But he wants to provide that, like I say, that stability and predictability for schools and the community colleges and universities to know that there's a commitment from this state to help reinvest in the system.
Further questions? Excuse me. Further questions? Squeak up. Thank you, Mr. Saker.
Thank you.
Mr. Reeder, any questions for Brian?
I have one question.
I do, too. You go ahead.
Mine's a very simple one. Would you give me a two-hour instruction on the QEM online?
You bet.
Okay.
I do think that you've made that offer available numerous times, and it would be an interesting exercise somewhere down the trail for just about everybody in this building. So that's a very good question. Earlier we had been talking about are there any schools or school districts that have funded their budgets at the full QEM? I can't remember if it was you or Dr. Burke who had indicated maybe a couple. Jim, you're going to check on that. So we've had then follow-up discussion then that the efficacy of the model has yet to be tested then. Would you care to comment on that?
Co-Chair Flores, yeah, in some sense, you're right. We don't have, since we have not funded schools to the level the model recommends, there's been no direct test of the model to know whether the level of funding it recommends will actually lead to the results that it predicts. And that's true. I think that's true of any kind of model which tries to predict how much it will cost to achieve some goal that you're currently quite a ways away from. So no direct tests, that's clearly true.
Further questions from the department? Senator Devlin?
One question. In terms of looking at the model and looking under some of the underlying premises, there was a remark in the QEM report about No Child Left Behind, which I think might be applicable to not only to the 99% in the No Child Left Behind, but the 90% in our standard, is not every dollar is equal in the model, right, in the sense of it may cost more to get that last 5 or 10% up to 90% than it costs to get the first 20 or 30% up to that in terms of the cost per child, the level of instruction, the amount of resources that would have to be devoted.
That's correct.
And at the same time, we had the testimony this morning earlier that we are in a changing environment. I think we saw one statistic in the subcommittee on education that would have shown over a 10-year period our level of children in poverty grew from about 30% to 40%, which is a significant impact on schools. Our level of English as a second language grew, I think, even more dramatically than that, quite a bit more dramatically. So there's a lot of issues in here, and not every dollar is going to be equal in terms of how much improvement in performance it gets.
Co-Chair Devlin, I think that's exactly correct. In almost any endeavor in life, trying to get that last little bit is usually far more expensive than the initial. And so students with special needs, there's probably 100 years of research that shows that students with special needs take more resources to get them up to a given level of performance than students from more affluent backgrounds or who are proficient in English, students who don't have special needs. And so as more and more students meet standard, the ones who have yet to meet standard are typically the ones who
have special needs and are more expensive to educate. So at the margin, it's much more expensive.
Thank you.
One of the reasons that the commission has been reluctant to try to predict how much it will cost to meet the goals of NCLB is that, you know, getting 99% of students to meet that standard is a condition that no state has ever achieved. So we have no experience of doing that. And what we know about the costs of educating kids with special needs suggests that those costs are very high, but I would argue almost impossible to predict with any accuracy.
Thank you.
Senator Walker.
Thank you. That raises a very good question, because I think this committee needs to look at that when we're trying to figure out why we can't fund education at the full level that we need to in this state. One of the reasons is the one Mr. Reeder just talked about, and it's funding of special needs kids. That we get money from the federal government under the IDEA program, and I don't want to quote the wrong number, and I took my briefcase upstairs, but they don't fully fund that. Okay. And it's 17%, but 17-18% is all we get from the federal government. So Mr. Reeder, who makes up the rest of it for paying for these children's education? It's local districts and state governments, correct?
Senator Walker, I mean, there are essentially three sources of revenue to school districts in Oregon: mm-hmm. federal government, local property taxes, and the state. So if it's not coming from the feds, it's coming from the other two.
Yeah, and I just want this committee to understand how much that hits our budget. And I don't know, you indicate that you can't put a number on it, but I know it's pretty high. And it's quite shameful, because the federal discretionary budget, about 52% of it goes to the military and 9% of it goes to education, human services, and some employment services. 9% goes to all three of those things. And that's why we aren't getting full funding of the IDEA. And we don't get full funding on NCLB either. So those are some of the things that I think we need to pay attention to when we're writing our report. Thank you.
Further questions for Mr. Reeder? Rhetorical comments, if you will. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tricia Smith, please.
Good afternoon, Madam and Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association and the 20,000 or so education professionals working in our pre-K Head Start programs, our K-12 schools, our ESDs, and our community colleges. I am going to be very brief this afternoon. You have had a very interesting discussion about education and how to provide our children with the quality that we say we want, and how much that costs, and how do we measure it, and all those things. But I would like to try to refocus the committee to your charge. And that's very simple. And it's contained in Article 8, Section 8 of the Constitution. Section 8 says, initially, the legislature shall appropriate to the public education system an amount sufficient to meet the quality goals established in the law. That's what you were supposed to do last session. The sentence goes on to say, and write a report describing, and I'm going to paraphrase here because I can't remember the exact words, describing the appropriation and whether or not it was sufficient or insufficient, and what the reasons for the insufficiency may be if it was insufficient. That's your charge. Your charge isn't to decide today whether or not the QEM is a good model, whether or not we should have more school choice, whether or not any of the things that were discussed today should happen. All of them might be good things, but that's not your charge. Your charge is to write the report required in Section 8 of Article 8 of the Oregon Constitution to describe the education appropriation coming from the legislature which was 5.263 if the 23 million comes in the next year, not 5.318 or whatever. And compare it to the QEM, which the statute says you should use to make this comparison, and describe for the public why the appropriation did not meet the sufficiency standard required in the Constitution. That's the purpose of your committee. That's the purpose of the report. So while we're talking about all the other things, I hope that you will refocus your attention to your charge and limit yourselves at this point in this committee to that charge. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smith, and I really wish that was the scope of our charge, because I think it would be a much easier report to write. However, the ballot measure or the House bill that was passed in 01 does tie us to the quality education model, and that is what creates the dialogue, the debate, the angst, if you will, about the trajectory that Representative Morgan referenced earlier today, that if we were talking about funding at the level that was established by either the governor or finally adopted by the legislature, it would help us an awful lot. But because we have this gap between where we are and where the model puts us, that creates the reason that I think we're trying to dig a little deeper. So,
thank you, Madam Chair, and I certainly do understand that. It is a very difficult position to be in, to feel hamstrung by a revenue system that doesn't allow you to provide for the needs of the state. Whether we're talking about public safety or education, I think we're all in agreement that we are not providing what our citizens need. But for the purposes of this committee, your charge at this point is to use the tools that you've been given to make the analysis the Constitution requires.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Smith? Thank you. We are at the point, committee, that we need to move into some discussion about the crafting of this particular statutorily required report, and provide the administrator with some direction so that we can come up with a draft report that we will be able to view, comment on, and at our final meeting at the end of the month then adopt. So the table is set for discussion in this regard.
Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chair, do all the members of the committee have what was prepared by the committee administrator in terms of the charge of the committee, or would it be good for him to go through that?
Mr. Keller, would you please review that for us?
I will.
I'm looking for mine. I know I have it here.
Hey. This is the overview of the committee responsibilities. The President of the Senate and the Speaker of the House have jointly appointed this committee to issue a report 180 days after the regular session of the Legislative Assembly adjourned sine die. Sine die for 2005 session was August 5th, and this report needs to be issued by February 1st, 2006. The co-chairs have scheduled two meetings to complete the committee's work, today, January 6th, and the last meeting on January 31st. Based on ORS 171.857, the committee's report is required to contain the following. Demonstrate that the amount within the budget appropriated for the state system of kindergarten through grade 12 public education is the amount of monies as determined by the Quality Education Commission is sufficient to meet the quality goals. Or identify the reasons that the amount appropriated is not sufficient, the extent of the insufficiency, and the impact of the insufficiency on the ability to meet quality goals. How the amount appropriated in the budget may affect both the current practices and student performances. If the committee determines that the report of the QEC should not be used as a basis for carrying out the reporting requirement, the committee would be required to identify the reasons for not using the report and outline an alternative methodology for making the findings required by Section 8, Article 8 of the Oregon Constitution.
Thank you. Senator Walker?
Thank you. There's
a lot of things here for discussion, but the first thing that pops out at me that I think we have to decide is 3A, which says demonstrate that the amount within the budget appropriated for the state system of kindergarten through grade 12 is the amount of monies. Well, we need to decide on what we appropriated. There's a difference of agreement here between the governor's office and the rest of the world about what we appropriated. So I would like to have an agreement about what we appropriated and then move on to the next step. Representative Riley.
Yeah, I don't hear a difference in what we appropriated. I agree with your number. I think everyone agrees with your number that that's what we appropriated. The question is not, the governor's statement is not that the legislature appropriated the number that they came up with. They added something to that to come up with their number. And so that has nothing to do with what we do. That's my opinion.
So what number are we going to be talking about?
It is the number that we appropriated. And that was 5263
is the number that we're using. Well, now I'm confused, because if we complete reading subparagraph A, demonstrate that the amount within the budget appropriated for the state system of kindergarten for grade 12 public education is the amount of monies as determined by the Quality Education Commission is sufficient to meet the quality goals print 2004 QEM estimate of $7.1 billion. Mm-hmm. So if we're talking about do we meet the level of funding as established by the set forth by the commission in its quality education model, which is currently at 7.1, 7.2, mm-hmm. Which is hydraulicked from time to time. Have we met that funding level? Clearly the answer is no. But I guess what you're trying to determine is, are we going to stick to the specifics of what our charge is, or are we talking real dollars as actually...
Well, Madam Chair, and I know co-chair wants to squeeze in here, but let me just clarify what I'm trying to get at here. Because in Part B, it says identify the reasons the amount appropriated is not sufficient. We have to know what we appropriated to know what isn't sufficient, because you look at the difference between what the QEM is, if we go with the QEM. Now, that's the other story, too. But I would agree with Representative Riley that we appropriated $5.24 billion plus that additional $23 million ratcheted up. They call it all kinds of different things, should we get more money in the state budget. So I think those are the two numbers that we use. And then we subtract that from the QEM, if we go with the QEM, and then that's all that money that we haven't met, and those are the things, that's why we're not sufficient, because this money could be used for this purpose, and I don't know. I may be getting too analytical and too anal, but, you know, that's a place to start.
Senator Devlin and Representative Morgan.
I think the basic premise that you're going to have to answer here is the actual question, which is, did you meet the level of the Quality Education Commission set? And the answer to that is a very clear no. Then the question is what funding level did you set? And what the ramifications of that are? And the Quality Education Commission spelled out in some detail what the ramifications would be of not meeting that. Also, they were required to present some alternatives, and they did present some of those alternatives, and the legislature chose to fund some of those alternatives, but not others, in terms of like the data system and some of the other things, so we could comment on that. I think the important thing here to keep in mind is, well, all of us would like to debate the future of public education for the next 5 years, and while all of us might want to debate what the quality should be and what the measurement should be for that quality, we have a very sort of defined role in state law, and that is to publish a report that basically outlines whether or not we met that figure of the quality education model, what the ramifications are of not meeting that. And I do believe, too, in the other side of this, where people have commented, we do have a right to comment on what we think the issues are in terms of why we did not meet that. I mean, we do have a right to comment on what our on what our revenue structures are, what our revenue structure is, what the challenges that we have faced in terms of meeting other requirements in state level, in terms of human services and public safety. We can clearly do that. I think we should also comment on that we do not know the full ramifications of No Child Left Behind and what effect that would have. We also might comment that we have to follow current law, that the future of the SIM and CAM are probably in question, and we do not know what changes future legislatures may make in that or other measurement standards. But I think our mission is just in that first section. And we're not going to resolve all the issues around public education here in this committee.
We're not?
Oh. No.
What are we doing here?
Why not?
So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Right there, good morning.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I do agree with Senator Devlin. I think that the primary question is pretty simple. Did we fund to the full implementation of the QEM model or not? The answer is pretty simple. No, we didn't. And that in terms of what we did fund to, I would suggest that we just give LFO the charge of continuing on some kind of diagram that just builds off of the one that was already in the previous report, which builds off the one that was in the report before that, so that there'll be some kind of continuity in the way that the information is reported. The twist in this one is the increase in revenue if the forecast increases, and I would leave it to them to design something that shows that, and I'm sure that they can do that. I agree with Senator Devlin that going through and covering those topics that were the reasons why we couldn't fund to it, and I think that doing the same, a kind of a look at potential impacts to school districts would maybe be worthwhile. I think it would also be worthwhile to update the information on the attainment levels of the students that are in the previous two, so that there's again some continuity and anybody who reads this report can see a relationship between funding levels and student attainments or not, depending on how it all ends up turning out. I would really urge the committee to consider continuing the format on so that there is a continuity in the discussion from one report to the next.
Thank you. Very good comments. Representative Riley.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that I absolutely agree that we should simply continue the format, update what we have, and make any other comments in the report that we'd like to include, but certainly keep the format as it is so that there is continuity.
Mr. Keller, let me ask you, are we prescribed to, or are we limited in any way to what we can address in our report, to your knowledge?
As I understand the statute, first and foremost, you have to meet the requirements of what needs to be in the report.
Right.
There is nothing that I found in statute that would limit it to just that, those topics.
So we could expand it. We could expand perhaps some of the concerns that have been developed here today or expressed here today from various testimony and even from those of us here.
Yes, ma'am.
In whatever areas would be appropriate as that discussion evolves under your creative writing influence.
Yes.
But I think that number, Senator Walker, that you're grappling with will be addressed in here. I mm-hmm. think that what our charge is to use that, as has been stated, the QEM number. Did mm-hmm. we meet it? No. Where did we come in?
Mm-hmm.
This level.
Right. And you're right, Madam Chair, and that's when I want to make sure we get that number in there. And that we all agree that that's the number we're going to use instead of this mysterious 5.318 that uses local revenue.
Gotcha. And if we were to talk about some of the things that have been expressed today, I would like us to be clearly looking at some of the record of the testimony so that we're addressing perhaps the lack of testing for the model as it's fully implemented. And I really liked the phraseology that Mr. Sager had used earlier in yet another context, but I think it applies here, that creates unsustainable expectations. And I think that that kind of captures what my concern is when you talk about the trajectory of where we are with real resources as opposed to what the model sets up. And in doing that, then we continue to perpetuate the dialogue of it's never enough. And when Mr. Reeder said there was 100 years of research to support the education for disabilities, people with children with disabilities, I suspect that we could probably go back multiple generations and find out that this dialogue is as old, that there is never enough for our education funding number. So I want to try to move us from trying to affirm the negative, I think I said earlier, to a more positive approach. And so I'd like some of those things addressed in there. Senator Devlin?
Madam Chair, one of the things I hope that we would do here is allow people probably till sometime like next Wednesday or Thursday to get comments to Mr. Keller in terms of some of the issues they saw brought forward here. And I know that you and I will have to meet a couple of times before a draft report comes out. And contrary to public opinion, we work relatively well together.
We do. It's wonderful.
And the other thing, though, is I do think that there are some things in here where we have to be pretty clear about what the impacts are. And that's why I brought out the costs in terms of the impact vary. It might take you 7.1 to get to the quality education model, in theory. But the improvements that you would see if you were at 5.8 now versus 5.240 or 5.263 or 5.318 are substantial in terms of what the improvements could potentially be. And I think we can just include some of those comments. You know, two areas that I think I could help with, too, is that, and I know Mr. Keller could request this, too, but I can get LFO to run new QEM numbers and new essential budget level numbers based on the changes that have occurred since both of those have been published. So you'll actually see what the actual difference is between what was appropriated to be honest, what was actually appropriated obviously was for the 5.240. But right now, the $23 million is virtually assured unless the forecasts go precipitously down. And if they go precipitously down, since they're already, I can't remember, $300 million or more above that, mm-hmm. we're in deep trouble.
We're tough. We're just in this budget either.
That's right.
And the other thing is I know that in the original that we included this thing on elementary schools and showing how they were doing, I would hope that we would do the same for high schools and middle schools, too. It's very easy to show elementary schools because we have extraordinarily good performance levels in elementary schools, and we have pretty good performance levels in middle schools. But I do not believe that our performance in high schools are anything to brag about. And so I think that we should show all three.
Well, Madam Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, from our discussions last session in Ways and Means, eighth grade, kids hit the wall, and you start seeing those numbers go down. And then you get into high school, and you've lost them, and you get kids going to work in the mall that say, these ones, would you like to look at these ones? I swear if I hear some other kid say, these ones, I'm going to smack them. That is such bad grammar. So I guess what I want to do is, I was looking at this report, and Representative Morgan wants to follow the format, and I'm okay with that. But I think we, as long as we're all here together, should sort of
quickly go through this report page by page to make sure we're okay with the stuff that's under there, or we might want to add something of our own?
Well, format is one thing, language is another.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we don't necessarily have to just copy this and say ditto and send
right.
it on.
So I or
we
do we want to do that today, or are we doing that next time we meet?
Well, Madam Co-Chair, what I'd like to do is to give people enough time to read through this and to actually empower them. This is sort of like a school assignment. If you think that there are things that the format, as the co-chair has said, could stay the same, but if you think that there are things that in the comments today should be included, that you get those to us by like no later than next Wednesday or Thursday.
So if I want these ones included?
If you want those ones. And Senator Walker, I just want to comment that I call that the hormone factor. It seems that from conversations I've had with members across the state, across the country, every state shows that there's something that happens
eighth grade
and high school level. And I don't think what we're talking about really is the hormone factor. But that's subject for another, and I don't mm-hmm. have the research to back it up to bring you, but I'll bet it's out there.
Madam Chair, I have expressed it that kids after eighth grade grow outside of close custody.
That's the way to look at it. Representative Morgan.
Would it be a reasonable thing to do to ask the co-chairs to work on a draft that would incorporate any comments that we would want to have in there that we would get to you by the middle of next week?
Yes.
And then to have that distributed back out to the members. I always do, I think, I do better if I have something to bounce
right.
off of.
Right.
Yeah.
And it would be real helpful to me to have a kind of an updated draft with that we would have the ability to comment on.
How about if we, Madam Chair, if we could hold it open for comments to Wednesday or Thursday, if Mr. Keller could get a draft by the following Wednesday or Thursday, about a week later, okay. and that would still give us time to comment well before the committee meeting and potentially chances to circulate this to see if there are any other comments that might be appropriate.
So I would encourage committee members to get your draft, your questions or areas of inclusion. Perhaps you could do a three-way to Senator Devlin, Jim Keller, and myself. Also make the opportunity available for anyone that might have given testimony that would be interested in making some. I failed to ask if there was anyone out there that wanted to give testimony, public testimony, before we moved into our discussion. Was there anyone else? I really shut that one down, didn't I? I apologize.
I might suggest that we just email our comments to Mr. Keller and he gets them out to all of us so that we can all see what we're all
That's fine.
Thinking
Absolutely.
About. And, you know, they're interested
to
party.
Work with email, too. It works the best for me.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I can do that late at night.
Mr. Keller.
I got smart, though. I hold it now until the early morning so people don't know that I'm working in the middle of the night. Because it's time stamped when I send my email. And then I get these emails back. Why are you up at 3:30 a.m.? So,
because you can be?
Yes, that's right. I'm a grown-up.
Any further discussion then? Are we all settled on our process here? We're going to get our comments to Jim by middle of next week. He'll have a working draft for us by the following week. And we can make comments on that, and we will come back prepared, better prepared for our meeting on, was it January 31?
Yes, and that's the meeting where you're going to need to adopt.
Yes.
Right.
And so there, I think maybe even further along from just receiving the draft, that we should probably put some time into commenting on it and getting ourselves to the place where we're ready to adopt it at the final meeting.
Is what we're going to have to do, I'm assuming, is vote on the comments that are going in there, because I might make a comment that you think is off the wall or vice versa, and so we're going to have to agree that, I think one of the issues is we're not attracting quality jobs to the state. We've got numbers of jobs, but they're not qualities of jobs that provide living wages and benefits. So then those people end up going to DHS, which now has a $172 million shortfall, and that takes money out of the rest of our budget. So I think those things impact our ability to fund education, too, but you might not agree with me.
So.
Well, and we can cross that bridge when we get to it.
Right.
And by the same token, I wouldn't be opposed to having an opinion inserted that I may not necessarily agree with, but it is an expression of concern from a member of this committee.
Yeah. Okay.
Madam Chair and also co-chair, I just want to express my gratitude for a very interesting day of testimony, and I thank you and Mr. Keller also for the work that you've put into putting this together. It's been a very worthwhile day.
Good. We always
hope. It almost
hope
seems like we're back in session.
It does. Don't we miss it, though?
So, Representative Morgan, this is your third one. Was this the most exciting one?
They've all been pretty exciting.
Okay. I won't put you on the spot.
This one is actually the probably one of the easier ones because this is an increase in the budget, and we haven't always been in that position. So
that what you're saying is the gap isn't as wide as it's been.
No, because the bar keeps getting raised, too, so I don't want to go there.
Yes.
Madam Chair, co-chair, do we have anybody that will, this is the entire committee, do we have anyone that will not be here on the 31st that we know of?
Good question.
Everyone can be here?
No.
Okay. On deck?
I've cleared my calendar unless something comes up, you know?
Okay. Well, thank you all for your participation. Thank you, gallery of guests. And I guess with that, we will adjourn.